of the pastors here. We have new vent pipe that's been run, but it doesn't work yet. So today's supposed to get to like 90, and so undoubtedly by the end of this, it'll be warm in here. So we have provided Bibles in the seats in front of you so that you can fan yourselves. And we'll get through this deal if the preacher doesn't get too carried away. So, some of you are probably wondering what in the world is underneath this deal right here. And some of the coolest memories I have of like being in school when I was a kid was show and tell. You know what I mean? At least it was halfway exciting. And I wanted to do that with you today because I have told you before that I love my job. I have owned and operated a business for almost 20 years now, Cascade Chimney Service. I get to go around and meet people all over the place. And sometimes it's hard, and sometimes it's interesting, and sometimes it's just really cool who you'll meet. And I've gotten, over those 18, 19 years of doing this, some really cool tips from people. You know, I mean, money's always nice, but sometimes we get tipped with something else. And this one I got 2 weeks ago, and I think this is probably the coolest tip that I have ever received from a customer. This gentleman is 90 years old. I've been cleaning his chimney and sisters for probably 8 years, 9 years. Every year he's been a customer. And 5 years ago, me and Gage were there cleaning his chimney, and we started talking about him and what he did for a living. And he was a ranger, a park ranger, all his life at Yellowstone National Park. And long after Teddy Roosevelt was president and out of office, would even take him on treks through the park. And he got really excited at one point, and he said, "I've got to show you this." And he ran to the room, and he brought it out. And what he brought out is the bottom left-hand corner of a clamshell. It's heavy. That's why I'm like going, whoa. This thing's like 60 pounds, okay? And he said, "This is probably the coolest thing that I ever found in all the years I'm working there." And me and Gage are thinking to each other, well, he's working in the middle of the continent in Yellowstone National Park, right? And I said, where did you find that? He said, "We were at 7,000 feet in elevation on a mountain, pit mining for travertine, and we dug this up." And I looked at Gage and I said, "Gage, what do you suppose that means?" And me and Gage started having a conversation. And this gentleman sat and listened to the conversation dead quiet because he's not a believer. He doesn't go to church. He's not a religious man. But his wheels were turning as we were talking, because you know that he's been thinking since 1950, when he dug that thing out of that pit, what in the world would explain something like that being there? And so 2 weeks ago, I went to clean his chimney, and he came out and he said, "You know, we're getting old. We're trying to downsize some things." He said, "I want to give you something." And he brought it out and he handed it to me. And he said, "I remember that conversation you and your son had 5 years ago when I showed you this." He says, "I want you to take it to your church and show it to them." So that's my show and tell. This thing is legit. If you picture it off the bottom left corner that we have there, it was probably 2.5, 3 feet. I think Brent, when he saw it, said that was the pearl of great price in that thing. You know what I mean? Like, that's the one Jesus was talking about. It's massive, but it's real. It's super heavy, so don't try to grab it, but afterward, I'm just going to leave it up here if you guys want to come check it out. Okay? The evidence of God and everything coming from God and everything being created from God is all around us, all the time. You do not have to have some big degree or be a scientist to know what you see and put two and two together, right? The evidence of God is everywhere. This speaks once more, and people are finding this kind of stuff all the time in places they shouldn't find it. Worldwide flood. Global flood. As ridiculous as it sounds, the Bible is right again. That's the only explanation why you would find this thing at 7,000 feet in the middle of a continent. It was underwater at one time. Salt water. Rapid burial. Okay? And we're not going to go into all the apologetics and stuff right now, but this is just a really cool evidence yet again. And this man was maybe thinking about it. He thought about it enough that he thought, well, you guys, this has more significance to you. You need to take it back and share it with people. So it's kind of cool. We don't have screens again. That's not becoming unusual. It's becoming usual. So one of these days we'll get it figured out. But we're going to get through this. I'm going to actually, we've been in nuts and bolts for a while. And what I want to do is I want to shift for a series of messages into worldview, actually. And we're not going to deal with apologetics or origins or anything like that today, but this is one that, in light of the evangelism that we've been talking about and being a missional community of believers, this is one that's been on my heart and my mind for a long time, and that is the condition of the world around us, the direction of our nation. How many of you are starting to have a difficult time when you look at the direction of our nation? If you look over the last 65 years at our culture and the culture shift and the culture change that has happened in our nation, what are some of the biggest things? And I know this isn't going to be good for the recording, but it doesn't matter. What are some of the things you have seen that have shocked you as far as the direction we're going? You can say them.
Lack of respect.
Okay, lack of respect. Taking God out of the schools, right? Even taking God out of the military.
The hatred of law.
What's that?
The hatred that we have. There's so much hatred from all parts.
But yeah, there is a lot of hatred. There's a lot of just bad blood in general between each other. What? Redefining marriage. Redefining gender. Right? Out of the government? Taking God out of government. When was it that Ten Commandments started coming out of courthouses? That was a while back. But yeah, we're removing that from the platform as well. What I want to talk about today is the culture war in America and how the Christian, how we as God's church are to view what we see going on around us. Because a lot of us have a wrong view, and therefore we have a wrong response or reaction to the direction that we're going. And this is a big subject today. And culture, all culture is, this is Webster's, the general state of manners, taste, and intellectual development at a time or place. That's what culture is. And I'm going to give you my ghetto definition because I like it better. Culture is the thinking, the ideas, the trends, the likes, and the dislikes that a person or a people group has adopted and received due to its natural influence. I know that's long, but that's culture, okay? It's really a product of what influences us most. And culture is everywhere, okay? Families, households, they have their own culture. If you came to my house and spent a week there, you would see a different culture than if you went to somebody else's house and spent a week there. There's things that we do. There's things that we, you know, maybe focus on or elevate a little more than other people would, right? There's a culture in churches even, okay? So there is this underlying culture in a true church of God that is built on the foundation of Jesus Christ and the Word of God, which helps make up the bulk of our culture. But even if you move from church body to church body, you will see different emphasis on certain things. There may be a different culture here when you come in and you come to the door for a few weeks as opposed to if you go somewhere else. It's not good or bad. It's just that there's a different culture there. There's culture that goes all over the place. And of course, our countries, our nations have a culture. And a big part of America's culture over the last 240, the short 240 years of its history has largely been one of Christian principles and values and influence, like you guys, like we stated earlier. And I like to call it a Christianized culture. We've largely lived in America as a Christianized culture. But over the last 65 years or so, that Christianized culture has been heavily questioned and challenged. And over that time, we've seen a slow and sometimes rapid dismantling of the Christianized culture that we once had in America, which has now brought us to a post-Christian era in this nation. That's really where we live. We live in a state of post-Christian culture here. And for us as Christians, it's hard to watch. It's hard to watch when we see all that we know. I think sometimes we just assume it's always going to be like that, you know? And it's not. It's hard to watch. It's disheartening. It's scary. It's tough to see the place we have come to. And it's frightening, even more frightening, to think of the place that it's going to go to. Like where it's going to go from here. And we almost think nothing like this has ever happened. Right? I know that Jesus is coming back soon because of what we see. I mean, a lot of Christians, like, we think that. Like, this is new. This is unique. In Ecclesiastes 1:9, some 3,000 years ago, Solomon wrote these words. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. We like to think that we're seeing something new, but we're not. Right? The sin of man and the widespread rise of its effects and its manifestations in society is an age-old cycle. It's an age-old cycle. Some of the sins may get a new look. They may be repackaged a little bit or get a new twist. But none of them are new. The sinfulness of man has always been. It just looks worse to us because we haven't seen sin run wild in this nation around us yet the way that we are now and the way that we're about to. Sin, basically, in the United States of America is just going to start to stretch out. That's all. It's like it's been a third-class passenger in the middle row between two big people. And it's just going first class now, right? Because we loosen the laws and the ordinances and the restraints of moralism, and sin then is able to stretch out. And that's what we're seeing. We're just starting to see man's natural wickedness stretch out. What we're really talking about here is worldview. And as Christians, to have a proper worldview is to have a proper theology. To have a proper theology. A proper theology is going to dictate how we view and interpret the world and the actions of that world around us. That's why we need to be in the Word of God, and we need to know the Word of God, is so that we know how to interpret and respond to what we see around us. The church doesn't need to hang its head in defeat because we've lost the culture war. And basically, guys, that we are in a post-Christian era, many agree all over the board from all different groups that the church has lost the culture war as far as our Christian influence. Okay, what I want to do today is make some of you really mad and talk about the reasons that's good. The reasons it's good. Now, I love this country. I thank God that I was born into this nation. This is the greatest nation, if I was to look at them all, that I believe ever was. If I was to get to look at them and choose, I believe I would have pointed at this one and said, I want to be in that one. We had nothing to do with that. Do you realize that? God, by His mercy and His grace, chose when you were going to be born, who you were going to be born to, and where you were going to be, where you were going to live, where that was going to be. And so I thank God that I have lived in this nation. I thank God for the memories that I have of growing up in this nation. When things were a little more tight, when things were a little more level, Those are good memories, man. And let's face it, when we do things God's way as a country, it's better for the people. So it's not something to throw out and disregard and say this was worth nothing. There's a reason why God hands down his laws and his ordinances to a community or to a people group. It's so that they will be more blessed as they live in community. And the United States has had that. But in the scheme of God's eternal plans and purposes, there are good things that are going to come out of America losing this culture war. And I just want to mention a few today. Here's number one. It will keep people from thinking that they belong to something that they don't. The loss of the culture war will keep people from thinking they belong to something they don't. I believe that anytime you have a Christianized society, you will have a ridiculous amount of tares in the wheat field. Like a lot. And yeah, God's going to sort that field, but what does it do to the church? What kind of effect does it have on the church? Does it sharpen its edge or does it break it off? Furthermore, just because society lives under a moral code doesn't mean that hell is any less populated. Moral living still sends people to hell. There's going to be a ton of moral people in hell. There are right now. In many ways, the moral code that we've had since the birth of our nation has been a shroud in ways over the reality of people's true condition. Yes, having that God-honoring code in place, like I mentioned, has been a benefit to society, but has it been a benefit to the gospel? Does it enhance gospel need, or does it hide it? Does it enhance a sinner's need, or does it dull it? We all know Satan's age-old MO, right? What is it? Starts with a D. Deception. That's his deal, right? If he can get us to buy into something that ain't true, then he's throwing a party. He's pretty happy about that, right? It's a grand deception, a large-scale deception, when a large percentage of the population thinks that they are in by association. How many of you hate false advertising? I hate false advertising. And I was reminded of that hate again 2 days ago when I went to the mailbox to get the mail, and there was this super official looking envelope, right? You guys already know this envelope. I mean, this thing looked like it was ultra important. And I took it home. It's like, open immediately and all that. And it didn't say much on it, like it was top secret. And I was like, who's this from? You know? And I open this thing up, and it's got a digital tag. Have you guys seen these? It's got a digital tag hooked to it. Right? With a digital readout. And I'm going, wow, this just keeps getting better and better, you know? It's like the kid on Toy Story with the Little Orphan Annie decoder pen when it comes. And I start reading it, and it says, you are the finalist to win this Toyota Prius. Now, I don't like Toyota Prius, but I like free cars. You know what I'm saying? And so I'm like, I'm a finalist? And it says, all you got to do is pull the tab on the digital readout, and those numbers just need to match the little scratch-off numbers on the back. If they match, you win. And so I like pull the tab, and you know, the lights are glowing out of that thing, and I flip that thing over, and I scratch it, and I'm like, that looks like the same number. And I'm flipping this thing back and forth, and it's the same number. And I was like, for the first time in my life, I just won something. And I walk outside, because my wife's out back, and I said, honey, we just won a car. And my wife walks up, and she takes it, and she just keeps walking into the house. And she's looking at it, and then she just opens the trash and drops it in, right? And I'm like, what's up? How do you know that fast that that's knowledge? She's like, honey, I'm the one who's gotten the mail for the last 25 years of our marriage. She's like, I get these every day. You won nothing. And she starts to explain the whole thing to me. And I'm mad because I went from here to here. Even if it was just a couple seconds, it was like, I won something. You know what I mean? And the juices are flowing. And I'm thinking, how are people allowed to do that? You know, how are they allowed to manipulate and play on people's emotions like that? Thinking of letting them think that they have something that they don't. And I'm like, I'm going to call this company. You know what I mean? Just like, stay there, I'm coming over. Click. You know? I hate it. I hate false advertising. We're not alone in hating false advertising. God also hates false advertising. He hates it. It gives him a bad name. It gives him a bad rep. And he's not fooled like we are, right? When you live in a nation that has identified itself as Christian, then it's easy for people in that nation to assume that they're Christian. To say that they're Christian, to identify as it. It's called nominal Christianity, okay? And nominal means to exist only in name. It means there's no substance, there's nothing below that title or that which they're identifying with. It's just to exist in name. Nominal Christianity. Identification by association. We see this throughout the Bible, and it never goes well. It causes a lot of confusion. Pastor Brent and Pastor Jordan have been going through the big picture where we're looking at Israel. We're seeing a lot of that. And of course, as we read the rest of our Bibles and we get to passages like Romans chapter 9, where Paul tells us not all of Israel is Israel. There is ethnic Israel. And then there is the children of the promise. True Israel. Right? Or like where we have the Pharisees, who are always pulling the card, our fathers, Abraham. They thought that that could get them out of everything with Jesus, right? Our fathers, Abraham. Well, just because they came from the nation that Abraham was the father of didn't mean that they were of the seed of the promise that came through Abraham. Jesus made that clear. He just flat looked at him at one point and said, you know what? Your father ain't Abraham. It's Satan. They had a completely different idea because of the association or the identification that they had. And just like there is true Israel and there is ethnic Israel, there is the invisible church and there is the visible church. And only one of them is true. And that's the invisible church. We can assume that because all of you are sitting in here today that you are the church, the true church, but the reality is that's probably not true. There's probably some in here that do not belong to the church. And I know this is hard stuff to talk about, but stay with me. The reality of true and false identity means that there are going to be many on that day, they're going to stand before Jesus and they're going to hear the words that nobody wants to hear on that day. That nobody is going to want to hear. Because many will come to him on that day and they will say, Lord, Lord, wasn't I an American? Lord, Lord, wasn't I a Republican? Wasn't I a conservative? Wasn't I pro-life? Didn't I have parents that go to church? Didn't I grow up in the church? And on and on and on. And they will hear those words, I never knew you. You thought you were something you never were. Association is not what pleases God. Assassination is what pleases God. The assassination of yourself. The laying down of your life, the killing of your life, so that you may be raised in His, is what God seeks. He is not seeking people who identify with anything. He is seeking with people that are undone without Him. That must have everything that Christ is, or they will die. The assassination of your life out of a real and a living need for Him is what He's looking for. That's the door code. That's what's going to get you in when you stand before Christ. People who are all in with Jesus. People who must have Jesus. And we must all come to the place at some point, and maybe this morning is that time, during our Christian walks, and I do it pretty regularly, where I got to sit back and I got to check the substance of what I have to see if it's really real. Because as I go through life and I fall through life and I fail through life and I stumble through life, as a Christian, all that stuff starts to pile up and saying, you must not be a Christian. It starts to throw me off and cause me to question where I really stand with God. Right? Peter tells us in 2 Peter to check to make sure your calling and election is sure. And if you read that passage in context, he's talking about it being based on faith. He's talking about adding and strengthening to your faith by virtues, not by good works. Faith is the absolute platform. Faith is the substance of all that it is to be Christian. If what you think you have wasn't built on faith alone and Christ alone, if it was built on anything else, you have every right to question the substance of your salvation. There is a controversial account in John chapter 6, which is the one that I always go back to now when I start getting into that place. And it's Jesus in the synagogue in Capernaum, talking to a crowd, teaching to a crowd, and he's on one of these subjects again that don't make any sense to the human mind. Right? He did that a lot. His sermon that day, his teaching that day to the crowd was, if you don't drink my blood and eat my flesh, then you can have no part of me. And these people at that point are going, okay, well, before we just thought you're crazy. Now we know you're sick and crazy. You're talking about cannibalism. And they're not understanding. It was a hard teaching, and it didn't go well. And so when he leaves the synagogue, all this group that had been following him all over the place, the Jesus fan club, because he was multiplying fish and bread, and they wanted to wait and see what kind of trick he was going to do next, this whole crowd comes and they're like, we heard about what you were talking about in there. Teach us. And he starts unpacking the same thing. And it says that when he was done, darn near that whole crowd walked away because they couldn't handle what it was he was saying. They left and didn't follow him anymore. And he turns and he looks at his 12 and he says, are you guys also going to go? And Peter responds, and this is the part that does it for me. Lord, where else is there to go? You alone have the words of life. What Peter did there in that small response was actually prove or interpret the teaching that Jesus was doing. Because Peter was showing that he had fully consumed and fully digested everything that Jesus was and everything that Jesus taught. He was saying, I believe, there's a lot of things I don't know, but I am all in with you because there is no one like you and nothing like you anywhere else. That's what Peter was saying there. And I know that when I start questioning myself and wondering the substance of what it is that I have, that's exactly where I go. That's the gauge that I check myself by, is that when things get hard in my life and the tribulations come and the pressure comes and it starts pressing down, or if I'm just in just a string of just failures that I'm looking at in my life and I go, how can I even be saved? I go back and I put myself in Peter's shoes and say, do I still know that to be true? Would I still respond the same way? Lord, there is nowhere else for me to go. I cannot walk anywhere else because you are everything. That's the substance of our salvation. And it brings me right back to where I need to be. Where I know what I have believed in and whom I have believed in. And I know that He is faithful in that. Right? I'm a firm believer that the best purifier of the church is persecution. The best purifier of the church is persecution. When pressure and calamity hits the church, it tends to clear the field. Right? It tends to get people from standing on the line to moving to one side or the other. The true church, the true faith, is always revealed when it's not comfortable to be a Christian. And when it's not normal to be a Christian. And when it's not safe to be a Christian. And when it's not popular to be a Christian. And when it's not acceptable to be a Christian. When there is a cost to being a Christian. And up to this point, American church has not been tested. But it's about to be. And I'm not trying to be an alarmist or anything like that. But if we just look at the horizon and see what the storm clouds are telling us, we will begin to be pressured and tested in a way that we have not before. And that's when God will say, "Well, the real church, please stand up." The defeat of the culture war in this country will steadily purge the false advertising and the identification by association. And it will be stronger for it. Which brings us to the next benefit of the defeat. It will cause the light to shine brighter. The defeat of the culture war will cause the light to shine brighter. Here's a trick question for you. Do you know what makes light light? What makes light light? People have said the absence of darkness. I believe it's the opposite. It's not the absence of darkness. It's the presence of darkness that makes light light. Correct? You know where I'm going with that? I told you it was a trick. Lured you in. My cleverness there. Genesis chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness He called light, and there was evening, and there was morning on the first day. What the dividing of the darkness and the light provide is contrast, distinction, separation, right? Definition. This is a very good thing. Just ask somebody who lives in Alaska. Right? Like they don't know which end is up. Because it's light there for 6 months out of the year and dark there for 6 months out of the year. Right? That division, that contrast is needed. Matthew 5, 13 through 16. This is kind of a quick paraphrase. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Let your light so shine before men that they see your good deeds and glorify your Father that is in heaven. This is a little off. I got to share this, though. This is just a little off. One of our kids, and I'm not going to say which one it was, all these years growing up, you know the worship song, the corporate worship song that we do, "We Exalt Thee"? Thought it was "We Are Salty." Like for years. He would sing, "We Are Salty." And me and Mom, when we first heard it, we thought it was so funny and so cute. We were like, well, at least it's still theologically correct. You know what I mean? Like, "We Are Salty." The church is called to be salt, and the church is called to be light. But if you light a candle or a lamp in a room that's already lit, who's going to care? Right? Who's going to benefit? Who's going to notice? The light of the believer and the light of the church was never meant to blend, but to stand out and to illuminate and to provide contrast. But that's kind of what it's been like in this nation for a long time. A light shining in a lit room. It's all blended together. There's been no real reason for us to do otherwise. And what is the light that Jesus is referring to? Well, if you do a word study on light, mostly in the New Testament, as far as its usage and context, where you find it talking about light, it equals truth. It's referring to truth. It's that which Jesus spoke. It's that which Jesus did. And it's that which Jesus was. That's the light that came into the world that the darkness could not comprehend, depending on your version, overcome. And we, the church, now, what are we? We are God's truth bearers. We bear that light, which means how we love God and how we love others, especially when it doesn't make any sense, is light. And that light is what offsets us from the world that we live in. Every year, for 4 days out of the year, me and actually Doug too, get to go to a pretty dark place. Right? And I've come to really look forward to these meetings there. But as chimney guys with companies, we go to the association, the Oregon Association of Chimney Sweeps, where just basically chimney sweeps from all over the state come and they get certified and they sit through classes and they learn rules and they learn regulations. And this group is a gnarly group. They are a gnarly group. As my old buddy Jeff Smith would say, they are rank heathens, right? They're just brutal. The way they talk, the things they do, it is just turned up to 11. Crazy. They all know where we're at. They know that I pastor a church and love Jesus and whatnot, and they don't treat me wrong for that. But this year was really bad. It just seemed worse than other years. And every time I would walk out in the parking lot or anything like that, there were just constant, they were just smoking dope, out in public. They had joints the size of stinking trombones. I told one kid, he showed me this thing, and I was like, you're going to need to get one of your ladders off the van just to get up there and light the end of that thing. You know what I mean? He was like, what are you going to do with that? And he's like, well, you're going to join me. And I said, no, but I'll call 911 and have them, just on standby for when you get into that thing, But your initial reaction is like, you see the cherry on the end of that blunt? That's how hot hell is. You know what I mean? Like, you just want to start firing. And it's totally wrong. We don't. These guys are constantly getting drunk. They're constantly getting stoned. They're talking in ways that are absolutely just crazy, But what we do is we see them as people, right? Doesn't mean that we condone what we do or we like what they do. We see them as people. So we treat them with love. We try to think of how Jesus would treat them if Jesus was there. Because they're only doing what they're supposed to be doing, like we talked about a few weeks ago, right? So we don't talk the way they do. We don't tell the jokes the way they do. We don't smoke the blunts the way they do. We don't get drunk with them when they do. But we're there with them, treating them like people. And I had three people on the last day of that convention, separate from each other, walk up to me and pull me aside and say, I really enjoyed my time with you. And these are the words that they all used. There's something different about you. Because I wasn't sitting there and doing the smackdown on them for every little thing that they were doing, but I also wasn't doing what they were doing. And I wasn't afraid to tell them why when they asked. Right? You are the light of the world. Let your light shine before men so that they may see your what? Not your good deeds that has earned you salvation, but your good deeds as a result of your salvation, and glorify God as a response. When we look different, when there is more contrast and more separation, the light will shine brighter. There are simple things that we do or do not do as Christians that are going to start looking very curious. as we move further and further away from a Christianized culture. It's going to look more and more unusual when we marry somebody once for life. I'm serious. That's going to start to look unusual. That's going to start to be light. It's going to look more and more unusual when we see a family clutch hands and pray in the middle of a crowded restaurant. Just those two little things right there in 10 or 20 years from now are going to look absolutely foreign when they're witnessed. Right? And there will be light where there once was not. Because those things are no longer common or expected or normal or ordinary. They're going to become unordinary. And there will be a reason why we do them. And people will know. Many Christians have the idea that winning the culture back is what maximizes the light. But the Bible and church history tells us the opposite. The darker the darkness grows around us in this world and in our country, the more the light of the gospel and the church will surge. There will be greater contrast and there will be greater opportunity. And last but not least, the final benefit of losing the culture war is that it keeps the church from getting too comfortable here. I don't know about you, but I have to admit, I've been pretty comfortable here as a Christian. Very comfortable here. We have been very, very comfortable. It keeps us longing for our home, our real home. Jordan spoke a couple weeks ago about the alien resident. It's a fine balance. We are called to be aliens here in this world, and yet we do reside, we have been called to reside here at the same time, right? It's the now and not yet. This is not our home. This is not our final place. It keeps us longing for the appearing of our King, and that's where we should be. Longing for the appearing of our King with great anticipation. Now, I hate what I see around me today. And I know you guys too, as Christians. I know you do. I have a strong desire to see justice served on the wickedness that's going on around us. And I know that you do too. But know this. The stuff we see promoted and celebrated and championed and called good, when it in fact is not, is going to be dealt with, but not by us. Not by us. It will not be fixed by us putting the right person in the White House. It will not be fixed by us appointing the right Supreme Court justice. Many Christians think that's the solution. It's not. It will not be fixed by us returning to our Christian heritage or roots. And it will not be fixed by us winning back the culture and Christianizing it again. A proper biblical theology tells us that it will permanently and utterly and finally be fixed when King Jesus gets on his horse and rides. That is when all things that are broke and off will be made right. When our Lord comes in the clouds. What needs to be fixed is beyond us. It belongs to one person. And he will execute justice and judgment, followed by full restoration, extreme makeover. He's going to fix everything that is broken. Turn to, go to Revelation 5. Let's close here. I know it's hot, but we're almost there. Revelation chapter 5. We're just going to roll on this for a minute. This is John. banished to an island and is paid a visit by Jesus Christ. So he's in the spirit seeing signs of a revelation. Or I should say, seeing it in signs. John says, "Then I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the scroll and to break its seals?' And nobody in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, 'Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals.' And between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw the Lamb standing as though it had been slain, with seven horns and with seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he went and he took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, 'Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation, and you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they will reign on earth.'" Now, I don't know about you, but that makes me want to jump. Like, that excites me. And the question is, what is this book that it is so important that this thing must be open? What is this book that's so important that it's in the hand of him who sits on the throne? What is this book that makes it so important that John, when he saw that nobody was worthy to go and take it, wept out loud? Well, if you read the rest of Revelation, we know, because it unfolds what's in the book. It is the final eradication of sin wiped away forever and ever. It is the judgment of God that must take place to clear the wickedness and the unrighteousness that has ever been from the face of the earth and the face of eternity. That is the importance of this book. When Jesus died on the cross, he didn't just accomplish our forgiveness of sins. And when he rose from the dead, he didn't just accomplish the resurrection of the dead and new bodies that are waiting for us. But when he died and when he rose, he accomplished the right to restore everything to its glorified state and to make all things new. He is the King who will come and who will set straight every crooked system and government and law and thing that we do. And it will never be seen again. It is not our job, but there is one coming who's going to fix it all. And he paid a high price for it so that you and I may have a kingdom that is far better than anything that we can imagine in the presence of God. Jesus is going to make straight that which is crooked. Well, where's the application in this? We've lost the culture war. Now what? I'm going to let you guys stand, if you can. Everyone's so hot, they're just like, what? Stand up? And I'm going to let the Apostle Paul give us the application of what this means in a worldview context of us losing the culture war and where we're at and where we're going as the church. This comes from Romans chapter 12. "If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, and I will repay,' says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If your enemy is thirsty, give him a drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. And be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. There's the light of the church that is set on a hill in a dark place. And there's our application. We continue to be like Jesus was, no matter how fast and how far and how hard this world goes down. Our job is to show people Him, the light of the truth. Okay? Do not be discouraged by what you see and the changes taking place around you. It is all going to be made right in a very right way at the right time. What God wants us to be as His church is faithful as truth bearers. Lights in a dark place. Okay? All right, Jordan, why don't you come up? The little show and tell thing will be here too if you want to come up and check that thing out a little closer.